And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host today. In the studio up first, we will be hearing from Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry. They're going to be here to highlight their first Friday show at the Jack. Ellen Nodder Andrews will be here to focus on the monthly support group Beyond Baby Blues. We'll talk with Elaine Schroeder about the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. And pianist Alexander Tutunov will be here with a preview of his concert as well as his master classes. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more today on KTOO News Juno. If you missed the live show, it's also available at 4 on KRNN and online at ktoo.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Water Resource Director for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says the Keystone XL Pipeline Project threatens water supplies for his reservation. The South Dakota Public Utilities Committee heard the testimony Tuesday. It's determining if TransCanada can still meet the conditions it agreed to when it was first permitted to cross South Dakota in 2010. Victoria Wicks reports.
Those who heard Doug Crow Ghost testify learned a bit about the Winters Doctrine, a 1908 court decision that people on reservations are entitled to use the water there without interference. He says the KXL project threatens to interfere. The pipeline is planned to cross the South Fork of the Grand River, a tributary of the Missouri River, and a major year-round source of water for Standing Rock. Crow Ghost says the pipeline threatens the water in several ways. He expresses fears that the construction process, trenching across the river, will pollute the water, and the ongoing drought in western South Dakota leaves the reservation vulnerable. Commission Chairman Chris Nelson establishes that Crow Ghost watches the U.S. Drought Monitor map on a periodic basis and then asks this question.
How much of the Standing Rock Reservation is currently indicated as being under any kind of drought condition based on that map?
The whole reservation is.
According to Crow Ghost's pre-filed testimony, the KXL project will use 79 million gallons of water. He says that amount will leave downstream water users in danger given drought conditions. And the water resource director says an oil spill is always of concern.
An oil spill in a water source, no matter where it's located, is always potentially bad for the residents and also the fish, animals, every wildlife there.
Crow Ghost compares the potential damage as second only to a nuclear blast. TransCanada did not cross-examine. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks.
The historic Desert View Watchtower at the south rim of the Grand Canyon National Park is transforming into a Native American Heritage Center. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the multi-million-dollar center is designed to preserve the canyon from a tribal point of view.
Officials with the Park Service say the project marks one of the first opportunities for Native American tribes to directly present information to the public in a national park. 11 tribes and bands with ancestral ties to the Grand Canyon will collaborate with the National Park Service and Bureau of Indian Affairs, as well as nonprofit organizations. One of the organizers is Lee Kuanwisioma, director of the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office. He says the center will show visitors the canyon's tribal history.
The Hopi people have been around the canyon for thousands of years, and they are still a living culture. There's still a deep relationship with the canyon. That's what we want to tell the visitor.
The Desert View Watchtower was designed by architect Mary Coulter in the 1930s. It was built to mimic ancient Native American structures and is included on the National Register of Historic Places. The watchtower itself will not be changed, but the facilities around it will be converted to house Indian art exhibits and other cultural programs. The project is expected to take 5 years to complete and is being funded by a collective of organizations. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A California tribe is calling for protection of fish following a U.S. Bureau of Reclamation decision. Members of the Hoopa Valley tribe in California say the tribe submitted a proposal to protect Chinook salmon, which was rejected by the agency. The tribe says the Bureau's plan to protect migrating Klamath Trinity River salmon does little to protect fish. The tribal fisheries director and tribal leaders are worried about a fish kill, which they say would be devastating to North Coast communities. The Bureau of Reclamation is holding public scoping meetings on its Klamath River plan this week in California. In a press release, the tribe says it plans to protest as the Bureau meets today. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Humboldt State University's part-time online Master of Social Work. The 3.5-year program focuses on decolonizing work with rural and indigenous communities. Applications accepted August 1st to 31st for a January start at humboldt.edu/social work.
KNBA and Recover Alaska are seeking inspiring stories of recovery from alcohol addiction. If you or someone you know would like to share a story of recovery as part of an upcoming online and on-air documentary video project, go to knba.org and click Tell Your Story.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And up first today on a Juneau afternoon, I'd like to welcome into the studio local artists Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry. They have an exhibit, an opening, coming up here at the Jack this first Friday, and the title is Happy Trails, Trails Mixed Media Artworks. Your artwork will be on display August 7th through the end of the month, and your opening reception is this Friday from 4:30 to 7 at the Jack. Welcome to both of you to the studio.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
So you are both longtime Juneau residents and sounds like lifelong artists. And here you are, and you were telling me that you've actually done collaborative art shows before. So this isn't the first time you've done it. So do you want to talk about that just a little bit, your history of working together as artists?
Well, we both have worked mixed media in clay and painting and wire sculpture, all sorts of different media. And our work has gelled in the past. We've had several shows in the past where we've had our own individual pieces and then put them on display. But this time, we've actually done a couple large wall hangings together. And we went out in my yard with large pieces of canvas, and we did a Jackson Pollock fern alder crazy fantastic wall hanging that actually worked, and using spray paint on canvas. And then we did another one along the themes of Happy Trails with local animals and their tracks, because those animals are leaving their trail indications behind, and so we thought it'd be fun for locals to try and look at the tracks, and also people coming in off the ships, tourists, to be able to think about animals and the tracks and the trails and how we all kind of fit together on the landscape. So those were two collaborative pieces. And then Fumi has done her artwork, and I've done my artwork, different phases of what we're currently in the process of doing.
Yeah, I'm just thinking our history goes back. Well, we both came from Berkeley, California, but we didn't know each other while we were going to UC Berkeley. We must have crossed paths a million times because Jane was in design, I was in art. But we met when I was teaching ceramics at the university here, UAS. And what year was that, Jane?
97.
Yeah, and so we've been friends since then. And 2007 was our first show when the Jack used to be on a different street, in a different place. And then we did every 2 years we would do a show together, and each show, let's see, Lost and Found was the first one, then Crossroads, Pathways, and then, oh, Masks and Muses was last 2 years ago, and then this year is our Happy Trail. So they all have interesting themes that I do recycled artwork, so I make things out of tea bags and coffee filters and soda cans, and this year I have some bats made out of used tea bags and coffee filters. I have a squirrel, too, that's filled with pine cones.
So, real pine cones, too.
Yeah, so, Norwegian pine that Ken Buzel planted.
You are answering my question. What is mixed media arts? I mean, you're describing it literally. So, but I just for people who maybe aren't familiar with it, what is mixed media arts? Have you always been collaborating in that way? And is mixed media arts, has it been around forever, or is this kind of a new part of the modern art world?
I think since cavemen were going into the caves and using charcoal and the materials that they had at hand to create artworks or symbols that they was part of their culture, that would have been very mixed media to begin with. So we're not talking about fine art where you go to the art store and buy your paints in tubes and get your camel brushes and camel hair brushes and then proceed with a stretch canvas. We're a little more freeform than that. And my pieces this time are crocheted for the most part. And so that's very mixed media.
Yeah, and I've always done found objects when walking through the woods or on the beach, you know, collecting driftwood and whatever and putting it together to create. Well, the last one was Masks and Muses, a lot of interesting little people and critters. But this time, the last show I had my mannequins, which were covered with Japanese newspaper, and I had like tangerine masks and feathers, etc. But this year, the mannequins are taking a different form, and I got a stamp collection from a Japanese friend of mine whose mother had passed away. He inherited the stamp collection, so he said, take it, I don't need it, make some art. So I have some mannequins that have a bunch of Japanese stamps all over it, and then I went a little further, and I made the Chazuke rice soup girls. They're made with these little packets of Japanese soup seasoning that you buy. Anybody that's Japanese probably would recognize the images right away. And so, you know, I use decoupage, I use glue, and put it on the mannequins. And then also there's an Earl Grey and a Lady Grey mannequins. And they'll be doing some interesting things, fishing and hiking.
So for people who come to the opening reception this Friday at 4:30, from 4:30 mm-hmm. to 7 at the Jack, and for people who come throughout the month to see your artwork, what are they going to see? You've described the two large wall hangings. How big are they? And then you have other works that will be on display.
Yep. So the wall hangings are 10 by 10, basically, 10 feet by 10 feet each. And then the artwork is in regular size frames or on pedestals, and I have some crocheted trees that will be sitting that are a couple feet tall, and they're not huge. So if I were to create a life-size tree, that would take a lifetime. But so we're working in miniature here, but it's basically a regular show with these two wall hangings to emphasize the connection with our environment and the animals and the tracks and the trails, happy trails.
Mm-hmm. But the process is what's really important, and it's hard to really, realize what Jane and I went through this summer to find some sunny weather. Well, it was sunnier this summer than ever, but
not
we
in
had
July.
We had to have the sun in order to do the first one, and then we wound up doing the second mural in her covered porch, but we had to do it half in portions because the porch wasn't big enough to lay the whole thing out. But the whole process was pretty spontaneous at first. You know, we just went around and started ripping up ferns and trees and leaves and flowers and laying it on the canvas and then getting cans of spray paint, different colors, and doing different layers. And it turned out really interesting, but the process was fun. And the second one we did was a lot more detail. We had to cut stencils of all the animals and their tracks. And, it was a lot more labor-intensive and trying to get the precision of laying everything in place, you know, whereas the other one was pretty much a free form and a lot easier to do. Both of them are they contrast because very different techniques. I mean, same thing with the spraying, but one is cutting the stencils and the other is using found objects. So, and also, you know, the other different pieces that are going to be in the show, that they'll complement the hangings. Like, for instance, I made an owl and a fish and a giant dragonfly out of coiled magazines that have been flattened and glued together with a hot glue gun. And I also have, like I said, mentioned the wire squirrel full of spruce and Norwegian pine cones.
And you've got your butterflies. And so I
the geisha butterflies.
Crocheted butterflies and dragonflies. So we kind of worked off the same anatomical model.
So, and I had a sneak preview. You sent some pictures in advance, and it all looks wonderful. So for people who are, if they've piqued your curiosity, you definitely need to go down and check out the art. We're going to have to wrap this up, but I've got kind of one final question for both of you, maybe a short answer. But when you say found objects, do you have an idea? When you see something, when you find something, do you right away have an idea? Or do you just collect things and then someday start kind of working with the things and the creation comes that way?
Combination of both. I've made one piece with a copper sheet that I found in my basement years ago. And suddenly I was using that copper sheet that had just been sitting there. But I knew it was going to work sometime. And other things... Usually you're working on a problem, how to solve it, what materials to use, and then you go into a store and you go, that's what I want right now, and you buy it.
I found the object.
Exactly.
Well, the problem is I'm a collector, and so I don't throw anything away. My family and friends will tell you, just give it to Fumi. She'll make something out of it. I even have friends saving tea bags for me and sending them, you know, that. I made a large tea bag kimono and used thousands of tea bags. So, but that whatever I find, you know, I always keep in boxes and I think, oh, yeah, I come up with a concept and that material would be great. Or if I'm walking on the beach and I find a really strange looking piece of wood, like Saturday Night Fever from the last show, you can imagine what that little piece of driftwood would look like. And so, you know, I'll say, oh, this is what comes out of that piece. It sort of speaks to me. So it's both ways, right, Jane?
Right.
So the show is called Happy Trails, Mixed Media Artworks by Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry. This coming Friday, opening reception at the Jack. The artwork's going to be on display August 7th through the 31st. Thank you. Real quickly, Fumi?
Oh, yeah, real quickly. If you haven't seen my lino print tea bag prints on used tea bags, they're on display at the Northern Tea House, which is down near the airport, and they'll be up. So if you want to see a different kind of recycled art, my prints are there. Thank you.
Thank you both for your contribution to the art world.
Thank you, Jamie.
Yeah, great. See you there. Bye.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song. Weather.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Trails to you until we meet again.
happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather.
Happy trails to you. Till we meet again. Till we meet again.
The Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 5th of August, 2015. 1850, on this day, on Monument Mountain near Stockbridge, Massachusetts, Herman Melville and Nathaniel Hawthorne met. There was a picnic. They had invited friends, and they became friends. For a year and a half, the two authors lived about 6 miles apart. During the most productive time, in their writing lives, Melville was working on Moby Dick, and Hawthorne was working on The Scarlet Letter and The House of the Seven Gables. It's the birthday of Wendell Berry, born near Port Royal in Henry County, Kentucky, 1934. His family had farmed tobacco in that county for at least 5 generations. He went off to the University of Kentucky, then to Stanford, studied creative writing there. He moved off to New York. He said he missed the work of the farm, but he thought he was beginning some kind of academic career that would carry him someplace. And then he was offered a teaching job at the University of Kentucky, and he accepted it. He went back. His first novel, Nathan Coulter, set in Port William, a fictional version of Port Royal, and a few years later, he became the 6th generation to farm in Henry County. He bought a farm called Lane's Landing, raising sheep and growing hay and corn. 1973, he began corresponding with poet Gary Snyder out in California. Over more than 40 years, they've exchanged about 250 letters, writing about religion and farming and philosophy, letters collected in a book called Distant Neighbors. It came out last year. Wendell Berry's most recent book, a collection of essays, Our Only World. It's the birthday of Guy de Maupassant, born in Normandy, 1850, one of the great short story writers, an apprentice of Gustave Flaubert. He published his first stories a few weeks before Flaubert's death, and in just 10 years, between 1880 and 1890, he wrote most of the work for which he is remembered today, 5 novels and 300 stories. And it was on this day, 1957, in Philadelphia, an afternoon dance and music show went national, hosted by Dick Clark, American Bandstand. They opened the broadcast with Jerry Lee Lewis's song, Whole Lot of Shaking Going On. The show aired 5 days a week. Within 6 months, more than 20 million people were regular viewers. The show ran for more than 30 years. Here's a poem for today by Wendell Berry entitled The Vacation. Once there was a man who filmed his vacation. He went flying down the river in his boat with his video camera to his eye, making a moving picture of the moving river upon which his sleek boat moved swiftly toward the end of his vacation. He showed his vacation to his camera, which pictured it, preserving it forever, the river, the trees, the sky, the light, the bow of his rushing boat, behind which he stood with his camera, preserving his vacation, even as he was having it, so that after he had had it, he would still have it. It would be there, with a flick of a switch. There it would be, but he would not be in it. He would never be in it. The Vacation, poem by Wendell Berry, from his new collected poems published by Counterpoint Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
Dove calls from a shelter belt on a hot North Dakota afternoon. Shelter belts, also known as windbreaks, are parallel rows of trees and shrubs planted to shelter houses, farms, and livestock from strong winds and drifting snow. In 1934, Franklin D. Roosevelt established the Great Shelter Belt Project to alleviate dust storms on the Great Plains. By 1942, 220 million trees had been planted from the Canadian border to Texas. Planted for people, they gave immediate value to birds and other wildlife. Like this orchard oriole, many of our common woodland birds nest in shelter belts. These corridors of trees often provide more food and nest sites and lack the predators found in solid stands of woodland, so they are great places for birds to live. In a North Dakota study, brown thrashers in shelter belts had higher nesting success than their fellow birds in woodlands. With incentives provided to farmers by the Federal Conservation Reserve Program, millions of trees are still being planted for wildlife. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45. Schedules for August are now available online. More information at 586-5325.
Our last storyteller for the evening is Timothy Miles. Timothy Miles considers himself to be very blessed with regards to life experiences. He has lived in Asia, Europe, and Africa, and has traveled extensively throughout the U.S. and the Northwest Arctic region of Alaska, from Little Diomede to Savunga, to name a few. He has cared for African elephants and big cats, herded camels in northern Kenya, worked as a wildlife biologist, photojournalist, flight medic, paratrooper, professional raft guide, and environmental activist, and a host of other experiences that continue to provide a river of stories. He feels Jimmy Buffett sums up his life best. If you ever wonder why you ride the carousel, you do it for the stories you can tell. He, his wife Lisa, and son Cedar have lived in Juneau since 2001. Here's Timothy.
I was a senior keeper for a wild animal park down in southern Oregon. And about, kind of like this. It's kind of, getting kind of dusky. It was warm and quiet. The park had quieted down. The animals have started to quiet down. And I was making my tour around the park just to make sure everything was set for me to go home and there wasn't any crises or anything to deal with. And as I was kind of going by the elephant area, I noticed that I was missing 7 African elephants. I knew about an hour before that, typically my routine was to go to the elephant barn and set out the meal for that night, and then in preparation, because they're the last to go in, they were missing. And I went into the area there, and I noticed somebody had figured out how to unhook the hot wire. I still don't know which one did it, but they figured it out how to take it off, and my thinking was they're probably up at the barn. So I went over to the barn, and I came around the corner, and standing in the doorway was Nandi, which was one of the youngest elephants. I'm always I believe in the power of names, and Nandi isn't really a powerful name. It's kind of like, oh, don't be so Nandi. Just go do it, So obviously the other elephants got her to be the watch, and she was standing there half in and half out doing. Looking around, and I came around, and I went, Nandi. And she looked, and her ears flared, and she immediately turned around and went in, and obviously was going, he's here, we're busted, I told you this wasn't a good idea. And I walked in, and I said, what are you guys doing in here? You're not supposed to be in here. And everybody's ears are out, and you hear this kind of blowing through the trunk, and everybody's kind of a little agitated and stuff, and I said, You, everybody out. And so we all went outside and we lined up. And I said, are you supposed to be in here? I love talking to my elephants. They were just absolute. They're amazing. They were like overgrown kids in big clothes. So we had this discussion and I said, all right, everybody in. The routine is they go into the barn and they all have their spots where they spend. That's their spot. And their food is laid out there. And they're not to touch it until we bow and I say, okay. So they're standing there, and then I knew I needed to take care of Tiki's foot. And so I got behind Tiki there, and I'm going, foot, 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 foot. And she finally lifts her foot up so I could take a look at it. Well, of course, I'm kind of positioned this way. And all of a sudden, I feel this rather large weight, warm, moist, yet comforting. And the fluid in it started making its way down my spine and pooled up about right here. And I was like, really? Right about that time, Tiki kind of turns and looks back at me and kind of goes, it's kind of like life, isn't it? Anyway, that was fine. And I looked over and I saw, actually it works. It's a nice moose. I looked across and Tanga, who is about 7 years old, he's the only boy of the group. And again, like I said, the process is we don't touch our food until we bow. And I say, it's okay. He's kind of like a typical little kid, kind of like, And he latches onto a cantaloupe and he picks it up and I go, Tanga, leave it. And he goes, how did that get there? It's not mine. I don't know how that got there. Which is really kind of funny, because if you looked on, I've noticed on Facebook, there's been some great little elephant videos on there. I don't know if anybody has seen them. And little elephants with their trunks remind me, it was kind of flashed at me last night. They're like little boys, naked little boys, and they've discovered the appendage that's there, and you can just see the look of, wow, what is this? We took Tiki up to Bellevue. We were up there for a fundraiser. Keeper and I went up, and we got in real late, and they ended up telling us that we could stay at the old airport. So you know how long ago that was, if you're familiar with Bellevue. There used to be an airfield there. We pulled in. It was kind of rainy. And we're going, this isn't going to work. She doesn't like sitting out in the rain. So we backed the trailer into an old hangar and proceeded to get a flat tire. That needed to be fixed. It's around 12:30, quarter to one in the morning. So we went to the local gas station, and the other keeper is going to handle the tire. So I took Tiki out of the trailer, and we were standing at the service station along this main road as the clubs were letting out that night. And you could see these people, like, you know, I don't know if anybody's done this, but they're, okay, just let me get home. Let me get home. What the hell is that? We sit and watch, and I'd stand here with this elephant, and you see these cars going by, and I go, Tiki, wave. And people would just, like, slip out, and one actually turned around and came back and said, is that an elephant? And I go, where? We went up, and we did our thing for the fundraiser and loaded her back up in the – well, actually, that night was kind of interesting, is that she doesn't sleep well. And then we were loaded up in the trailer, and we're heading back down to the park. She gets in the trailer, and she loves kind of doing this rocking motion. And if you've ever tried to drive when something that big is kind of doing this, it's really kind of interesting. And I happened to look in my rearview mirror, and I saw a white VW Rabbit come in right behind us, draft. And I said, well, okay, that's an interesting. That's not really safe going along. Next thing, I look in the mirror again, and I see this huge cloud, like a big fog, just rolled in from out of nowhere and completely enveloped the white VW Rabbit. Elephants, you have to realize, come from an arid country, and they consolidate their water, and they only use enough to get rid of the toxins, the pee and that sort of stuff. They don't use a whole lot of water, so it's rather thick and viscous. Well, it went all over this rabbit. And next thing, when it did come out of the fog, the windshield wipers were going. There was lots of water being sprayed on there, and again, it's really thick, and it was matted all over the top of the car. He came around alongside. I mean, obviously, he was a fan of the zoo because he reached all the way over to the passenger side and said, you're number one. Thank you for allowing me to tell my story.
And that was, excuse me, that was Timothy Miles, and that was from the May Mudroom, recorded here in Alaska's capital city. Next on a Juno afternoon, Dr. Alexander Tutenoff. And I got the doctor part out of the way. Now I'm going to call you Alex for the rest of the
interview.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Acclaimed pianist, and you are in town for a recital this evening, but also to do master classes and private lessons. We'll talk about those things in a moment. But you just got in today, and your recital is actually this evening. So it's at Northern Light United Church, downtown, 7 o'clock. Tickets at the door or in advance. And welcome back. My understanding is you have spent time in Juneau, Alaska before.
I don't qualify for being called a native or even a local, but of course in my heart I like to think that I carry part of Juneau everywhere I go. So I'm in love with this place. It's official now. So, and it's great to be here. It looks like I may have brought even a better weather with me, which I always do.
Thank you. You can ask
my students, but now it backfires because I'm horrified that my recital is tonight and it's so beautiful outside. Well, we'll see what happens. I'm going to be playing different stuff from what I played last year and the year before and 7 years prior to that every year. I've been blessed to receive pretty impressive education, and so I still have a few more songs up my sleeve, so to speak.
So the recital tonight.
7 p.m.
7 p.m. Tell us about it. Whet the appetite of the audience here for turning out.
Well, I don't want to kill the surprise, and maybe if I name, I will play Bach, and usually I like to start with the music by Bach. It's just something so special about it. It's passed the test of time. The guy is, 385 years old or something like that, and we still enjoy his music. But unlike my usual fare of 3-4 minutes of Bach, I'll play more like 15 this time. It's this very involved piece of music that's rarely performed. I will play some Chopin. And I know there will be people who will like Chopin always wherever I go. And then I'll play the main feature of the program will be by Schubert. And that composer died at the age of barely 30 and left us with 9 symphonies and 20 sonatas and 600 songs. During his lifetime, people had no idea who they are contemporaries of. He lived a few blocks from Beethoven, but he's very different, and again, not often played. So very dramatic piece of music, about 25 minutes. After the intermission, it's all fireworks, so I'll play Prokofiev and Shchedrin and Berlioz, Mettner, and it's a program I played last weekend, 4 days ago, in Washington, D.C., the second half of the program. So they liked it there. So see what happens tonight.
So a pretty story.
Tomatoes are in season now, I understand.
I was told in advance you had a sense of humor. So is that a part of the performance as well, or are
and
you pretty
survival.
Traditional?
I don't change the music, but instead of lecturing people, I like to talk between the selections, but instead of doing the dry information, I'll probably say what I feel when I play this stuff and how I came to love the music that I play. Because if I don't love it, I won't play it.
You grew up in the Soviet Union. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about your being raised there as a musician and then leaving and coming to America.
It's a huge chapter, and of course, if people want to talk to me in detail, stay after concert and buy me a beer, we'll talk. But in a nutshell, just like other professional schools like athletes and soccer players and gymnasts and ballet folks, I was taken from the family into a boarding school. Basically, there were 85 kids in Moscow. Everything was free, and we lived there. The teacher-student ratio was, it wasn't student-teacher ratio, it was teacher-student ratio. I think we had 3 teachers per student on average, and they just pounded so much knowledge into me. And surrounded by the same kind of kids, I thought that was normal. I didn't know I was a freak or being raised as a freak. We thought that reading through an opera or a ballet music out of the orchestral score was not what an average child would do. We thought that was normal. So that was first 13 years of my life, and that resulted in 3 bachelor's degrees by the time I was 21, probably, which of course didn't make me more popular when I was drafted to the Soviet Army. Then that was a big reality check. But it was too late to change the career, and now I get to do what I love to do, and I actually get paid for it. It's fantastic. And it was a good experience. I won't lie to you. I will not say I was tortured in Soviet Union and I was glad to escape. I had the nice thing going, but I have a much better thing going on here.
When did you come to America?
The year was 1993, so the Soviet Union just fell apart. Of course, we were lost, and I didn't know if I needed the, you know, I wanted to be closer to the family, but there was an opportunity to come and study in the States, in Texas. That's where my accent's from. And then after I graduated, there was a 1-year appointment at the Wesleyan College, and I was lucky to be chosen. And so I thought, 1 year, maybe help me pay my student loans and stuff. And then it turned to be 3 years, and then I discovered the job in Ashland, Oregon, and the rest is history.
And then your connection to Juneau. So at some point you had the first time you came up here, because you've had now 7, 8, 9 years of involvement with the community musically, correct?
It was an amazing story, and there are a lot of individuals that help it happen, and I'm forever grateful to all of them, Mary Watson, Allison Brown. I came as a visiting professor at UAS, and that was already 10 years ago, but how they learn about me, Kyle Wiley Pickett, the former, oh, it pains me to say, former Juno Symphony conductor, he brought me here to play Rachmaninoff Concerto. I think it was in 2001, maybe, so 14 years ago. And then I came back. We had a successful fundraising campaign, bought a Steinway, the top of the line piano for UAS. And again, the students that I've met here came to study with me in Ashland, Oregon. So I have not stolen your talent, per se. Some are coming back, actually, so don't judge me. But, yeah, it's been a wonderful ride, and it's evolved. I'm no longer affiliated with UAS, but still this visit is, we nicknamed it as a Tutnov immersion, so people are invited to immerse with Tutnov. So today is Wednesday, I'll play the recital, and tomorrow at 8:30 I'll start teaching. I go pretty much all day. Friday, I have a few students scheduled, but the afternoon is free. Saturday, 9 to noon in the morning, it's an open master class, and people are welcome to come. All of the events are held at the Northern Light Church with a beautiful piano, great acoustics. And Sunday, mark your calendar, I will make arrangement for a worse weather. 3 p.m. will be this concert that the students will put together, and it's free, 3 p.m. I'm double-checking. Yes, and it's going to be fun. Again, there are still a few slots available for one-on-one lessons, but for the master class, you don't even have to be a pianist. Just come if you want to learn about music and the thinking about music and making music and ask all sorts of questions. I'm prepared.
So for people to make contact with you to find out about availability, a local phone number to call or a...
There is one, but there is a website,
even
actually.
Better.
And it's thrashhill.org, and you probably know about the Thrash Hill. Mm-hmm. They've been instrumental in making this happen. They put me on their website, and do I spell it? Or
sure,
it's,
yeah.
So it's T-H-R-U-S-H Hill, H-I-L.org.
So the on Sunday, the kind of the last thing you're doing, I think it's the last thing you're doing when you're in town, the performance with the students. Who are the students? Are these the people that you've been working with this whole week that while you're here, or is it a different group that you're working with?
Most of the people I've seen a year ago or also 2 years ago, so they are returning, and some would be even playing for me over Skype nowadays. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness for modern technology. But they have regular lessons in town. And we're not talking a huge number of students, but all of them are very excited about the piano. All of them very talented. The concert probably not going to be longer than an hour. And I'm not sure if I'm going to play anything on that concert because I'm going to play tonight. But we'll see how it goes. And I don't know what they're going to play on Sunday, honestly. It's going to be decided in the course of our lessons in the meanwhile, interim, right?
Mm-hmm. Interim, yes. So at what age were you playing piano? Were you a child prodigy? I mean, was it something you came into in your teens? Or
just like other, you know, very competitive professions, I started piano lessons when I was 3, and at 5, my then teacher said, you know, you got to go to Moscow and audition for the conservatory there. I think you got a chance. There were 200 kids, and they accepted 3. I was in the number 3 of those lucky 3, or so I thought. My mom told me she would take me to a zoo if I do a good job. So little did I know. But, yeah, it's been very rewarding and very competitive. Every jury, which is an exam, we had 2, 3, 4 of them each year, could end up being my last one. Because if people say, well, he didn't cut it, pack your stuff, go home. But that competitive element, of course, helped me. Actually, I think it helped me become a better person. It seems like I should have just hardened, you know, my personality and developed a huge ego. But it's the opposite. Only if you make friendly ties and connections with your colleagues can you survive this kind of environment. And for most people, summers are, you know, relaxing time. For musicians, it's time for festivals. So it's a year-round job, and it's not 9-to-5 job. But like I said, I love what I'm doing. I love working with people who love music and piano. And that's why I love coming to Juneau. Well, fishing helps, but, you know, it's a French benefit.
We've been speaking with Alexander Tutanov, a acclaimed pianist who's in town with a recital tonight at the Northern Light United Church, 7 o'clock. He's also available for master's classes and lessons while he's here. You can get a hold of him at threshill.org. Is that correct?
Yes.
Threshill.org. Alexander, a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for your musical talent and bringing it back to Juneau. And I do hope you get to go fishing and or mushroom picking, because those are the two things that I was hearing about out in the green room there.
There is no way around it. I'm going, but my first goal here is to bring a little more music here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.